Transformers in my collection.
Well,
also, with the way the program is configured, the way we've had it set up, there will be a great time savings because of repeated fields. So if I'm putting in a whole sequence of records by Mozart, I won't have to type Mozart, comma, Wolfgang Amadeus every entry. I can just have that field repeated, and I can just skip that field entirely. And you can have in the program as many or as few fields repeated as you wish, depending on what type of material is being carried from one entry to the next.
I know, and I'm aware of those devices and have used them. I do have a question, though. All I can say is my experience has been quite different.
Mine may well prove to be have been very optimistic myself. I will admit that, yes.
But at least given my experience and following the computer literature, the only thing that I have been able to see on the horizon which might ameliorate this situation, and I'd like to ask if anyone has had actual experience, not theoretical ideas, but actual experience with this, that might ameliorate this situation are scanners. There are handheld scanners now, as a matter of fact, which are available, which will, if you draw them over a typed or otherwise clearly, I emphasize, clearly printed line, I think it's usually printed, will enter that data into machine-readable form. Therefore, if you have a existing typed list of some sort of your collection, and many people do, you would, in theory at least, be able to use one of these scanners, which I think are now down around the $1,000 or less range, move it over your existing list, and if you're set up properly, it would go directly into the computer from there. You might have to do some cleaning or editing, but it would save an enormous number of amount of typing. My question to the panel and to people here is, has anybody actually done this or had experience with it?
Not at the collector level, to the best of my knowledge. I know some of the institutions are testing various types of scanner collection, and I hope that the AAA committee is going to be able to report on that sort of thing one of these days. But, Jerry? Yes.
I've had some experience with actually scanning typed lists, and a typed list can be scanned. You can actually find in large cities companies that will do that. The problem is that often, because of the registration of your typing, things don't always come out quite right, and there are errors. You must very carefully proofread it. It generally will transcribe most of what you've done. And as long as you've got a really good, clean copy, it can be done well. But this means, first of all, that you have a type list. You've already generated it somehow.
Okay, thank you.
Next.
I'm Philip Rockland. I'm a private collector. I do not use a computer for cataloging, except that having, as the ARSC executive director, I have the ARSC computer, so I do some of the keyboarding for my 3x5 cards. The 3x5 cards were started in 1946-47 when I was in the Merchant Marine, and while everybody else went looking for prostitutes, I had the first and second edition, not volume one and two, of the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia. On the way back, I cataloged the records that I had bought. But what the purpose in coming up here is to tell you about how I did the record of singing, because I am a professional librarian, but I was never a cataloger, so I never had the kind of tunnel vision that professional catalogers in the business have. And when I first got volume one of the record of singers, which you remember is the revised version in two parts, 6 + 6 plus the one supplement, I looked at this thing and said, no way am I going to keyboard or type all these names. So I used a Xerox machine. I Xeroxed the listings in that little booklet that came with it. And since I have a composer and artist index, I made two copies. I cut them up, pasted them with one of these wax spray things onto 3x5 cards, alphabetized them, and filed them. And it didn't take me, I think you said, 6 hours to do it. I don't remember how much. It took me a lot less. But more to the point, I didn't have to keyboard, proofread, or anything else, and that was more important. So I give you all that. Don't resort to tunnel vision if there's some other kind of technology available, like a Xerox machine, please use it.
Thank you very much, Phil. I have to take issue with your characterization of catalogers as having tunnel vision. I think that you must remember that you must remember that they work under somewhat different constraints, and they have a certain goals that they must reach. But your idea about cutting up Xerox sheets and pasting them onto cards is an excellent one, and I know many other people have done that too.
I'm Ellen Johnson.
Okay, quickly.
One of my earlier embodiments of the partial collection that I have, listing that I have, and which we still use at home, and it's one of the ways in which Jerry Gibson and I became acquainted, is a Xerox of the label of all of the records that I had available to Xerox at that time in multiple copies of the Xerox so that I could literally cross-file and cross-reference that way. It was fairly bulky, but it is still a very usable tool. So as far as xerography being used as a helpful technique to you, I agree with Garrett. I recommend it. Sorry.
Next.
I'm Ellen Johnson, University of Kansas, and we just discovered that we are going to have a special program on our computer in our archives. So I'm interested in Garrett's statement that you can take recordings, label and issue number, and send them into OCLC for a printout. How much does this cost? The costing they gave us seemed to me very high.
No, the cost was quite inexpensive. I'm sorry, I can't come up with that number right off the top of my head.
Do you have any recollection of how many you did and what the total cost was?
Yeah, we did. We ran about 23,000 through, and with a hit rate of, well, we're not really exactly sure of the hit rate yet because we still haven't finished the project. We haven't gone through and matched the records against what we pulled in. The hit rate was probably someplace around 65% to 75%.
And they charged you, what, $3 per hit?
I don't think it was that much. I think it was much less than that.
You think it was less?
Yeah. I'll find out the information and send it to you.
Okay. Okay. Also, for you folks who have been listening to all this wise information on DBase, if you're an amateur, forget DBase. Go down to your computer shop like I did and tell them you want the simplest program that they can sell you at the cheapest price. And they will give you one that will do data processing, letters, and everything else for a fairly nominal sum that you can handle yourself. The one I bought was Q&A, but I hear there are some, that's a couple of years old. I hear there's some new ones out just this year that are marvels.
Get what you pay for.
Paul Mawinney from Recordrama Sound Archives in Pittsburgh. In 1976, we started our database, the Music Master database, with it, most of you are familiar with. This coming month, we're going to be dumping that into a new database in a new language. And we were successfully able to convert without any loss of information. My new system is going to be a DBase clipper, and it's going to be able to do a lot more things. But it is possible to write the software necessary to transfer those things without any losses. There seemed to be some concern about collectors or librarians putting it into a language which would not be retrievable. We were able to do it. I don't know if anybody else will be able to, but I assume that it's something that anybody can accomplish. That's all. Yes.
Yeah. Any database that you collect into a computer has the potential of being converted into another database program. The problem is that you may not have the expertise nor the financial resources to do it. And if you're a large institution, you probably do, and you may be able to have the financial resources to take care of it. And in that case, there isn't much of a problem. But one of the things you always have to look at as you put together a computer program and start entering your data, remember that the most expensive part of the whole system is your data and your data input. And it's the most valuable part of it. And that's the part that you want to protect. And that's the part that you always want to be able to get out in some form. I thought it was really good when you said, David, that one of the possible things that the outputs that you would get out of your system was not only a screen output and a print output, but also a data file output. And I think it's really critical that any system be able to do all three of those things. Whenever I see a system that only gives you output to a printer, I trash it. I mean, I don't want to deal with that. I don't have time to sit around and wait for something to go out to a printer. It's got to come out to the screen if I want to look at it, and then if I like it, then I'll put it out to a printer. Or it's got to come out to a text file so that I can work with it, do something. Like Elwood had pointed out, you know, once you've got it in a text file, you can put it into your word processor, whatever it might be, and you can do a lot of things with it, a lot more things than you can do with a database program. You should never consider that a program is one, you know, is the ultimate. It's going to do everything for you. It will only do part of the job. And as you heard from Elwood, you know, he uses it only to put in data for a database program, and then he uses a word processor to do other things. Okay.
Taking that one step further, I think that in addition to being able to print and put it on the screen, I think it's important, if you're building a sizable database, to make it possible to put it out so that you can reproduce it on a CD-ROM, which I intend to do with my database and service it quarterly. I'm going to offer that as a service in the future with a ROM reader. So you have another additional way to utilize that information for everybody.
Good. Thank you very much. Next.
Steve Smolian. A couple of things, one of which has to do with one of the basic reasons, I think, for having a catalog, which is to find out when you're offered another record whether you already have it. I have found one of the most useful things I've been able to put into my own is to discriminate between the manufacturer of the record and the manufacturer of the sound that is on the record. And I have separate fields for each, so that you can have a record that is, say, Erato and issued on Musical Heritage Society, and if the Erato shows up, you know if you have also the year of recording or some other way of identifying it, that it is the same or it isn't the same. It's particularly helpful with 78s, I might add. One other point, which I think is important, is not to be reluctant to spend the money on reference works that you will require to put your catalog together. That's a part of the cost of doing a catalog, and if you scrimp on that, saying to yourself, well, I could buy X number of records with the money I'm spending on all these books, you are going to have just that much more chaos as a result. Be prepared to spend money for the proper working tools. One question. How many people here already have a catalog of some kind for their collections, just by a show of hands? Pretty nearly everybody. Okay. Of those people, how many of you, is this the first catalog? Let me put it this way. How many of you is this the second or later catalog of your collection that you have done? Yes. Well, a great number.
What he means is, is this your second or third try at a catalog?
Yeah. I think that that's true of a great many of us who have been working in cataloging, and I just want to, as a point of encouragement to for those of you who are facing it for the first time, not to realize that you will frequently develop a system, work your way into it, and then decide for some reason it won't work anymore. You then go through a mourning period before you can start up again. Be prepared to go through that.
Very true. Good words. Jerry?
Hi, Gary. Jerry Gibson from the Library of Congress. There were comments, or information was questioned or raised a moment ago, exactly what the cost is for some interconnect time. Press release from Arlen, which came out May 15th of this year, is announcing a new interconnect access search only to Arlen's data bank. They say total cost for 10 hours of searching is $219, which is a pretty good price, $21 an hour for searching for the Arlen file, if you structure it and work it right. The other questions are comments that have been raised concerning a file transfer system. I've worked with a program called ProCite, which I found very, very useful, very, very helpful, and it incorporates, as far as I'm aware, all of the questions that I've heard raised today about special program needs, fields, changes, structure, whatever, file output, and so forth. The program itself lists for about $300 the links to the various commercial available files and to the major library network files are $100 to $125 per link. The link takes the file, reads the tagging in that particular system, cross-loads it into the bibliography, the ProCite citation. If you don't know it, and if you're considering, you should look at it. It is a very, very useful file. The fields are infinitely expandable within the confines of your equipment that you have available. I strongly recommend you at least look at it before you, if you haven't bought something and are involved with it, look at it, please. I think it's extremely good. The single limitation that I have found with ProCite is that it will hold only 37,000 citations. For most of our collections, that will be more than adequate to catalog personal collections. And that combined with the search link time, which is now commercially available from Arlen to download, to cross-load, and I presume a similar thing is probably available from OCLC, or if you have institutional access, it probably wouldn't cost you anything because of access time already set up. It might be a lot faster and cheaper than rekeying or keying your own file yourself.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, that's one of the, there are a couple of database programs that do similar sorts of things, connect to one of the national databases, Arlen OCLC, or OCLC, and allow you to download data and then edit it to your own specifications. And that one is actually, I understand, one of the better programs. Okay, next.
Hi, Les Waffen from National Archives. We were talking a little bit about the OCR and optical character recognition methodologies, and National Archives the past 3 or 4 years has been doing a study of by its archival research and evaluation staff on comparing scanning methodologies for conversion of typed, printed, handwritten, and microfilm materials. And I'll put a sign-up sheet out by the desk there where I can send people this 8-page report that's come out of our research staff, which talks about the different systems that are available now. And some of it's state-of-the-art, and some of it's as you were saying, very, very difficult to work with, because they found that when they were doing some of the scanning methodologies and testing them, that paper-based textual materials only that use very contemporary electric typewriters could be successfully read and converted. They found that with the different font recognitions and the different problems that the scannings were only occurring, being able to accurately do 60 or 70%, and that it was not feasible, that the time required to detect and correct the scanning errors and properly format the document would exceed the time necessary to rekey the whole document from scratch. And so what they have come up with, and a system that they've currently let out a contract for at the National Archives, is this British system called Opterom. The systems that are available now fall into maybe three classes. First, they say there's the simple first-generation desktop readers, where they employ matrix matching techniques to read a limited set of typed fonts and point sizes. And the second level, they call them OmniFont systems that comprise most of the current generation of OCR hardware and software. And these are a combination of recognition methodologies that are used to recognize a wide variety of typesets and printed fonts and point sizes. The Opteron system that's being looked at now is really years ahead of whatever's available now in the United States. And this is a trainable OCR system. They use artificial intelligence capabilities, and they recognize, instead of just different characters on a printed page, the system is trainable to be able to recognize phrases and pictures of words and phrases. And it's even available for the National Archives, is very important, for cursive, handwritten documents, where you'll be able to scan a 19th century military pension file and be able to convert that then from scanning into a text image, which then can be indexed. So it's this system now that the National Archives is working with, and it's what they call a text conversion system that can process not only per-quality typed and printed materials, but handwritten documents as well. So if anyone's interested in the report of this scanning comparison of these scanning methodologies, I'd be happy to make it available, and I'll put a sign-up sheet out there.
Do you know how much the cost of that machine is, that system?
No, not at the moment. Okay. I'd have to look through some of the other.
I've looked at a couple of systems, and they usually, you know, you can buy a scanner for a couple of thousand dollars, but the software costs you somewhere from $50,000 on up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite home ready yet. Thanks a lot, Les.
Okay.
Another question?
Vincent Pelote, Institute of Jazz Studies, Rutgers University. I just have a comment and a couple of questions. First comment is for anybody doing institutional cataloging, just a warning to make sure that whatever you decide to do in terms of minimal information, that you put in everything you mean to put in at that point, because if you think you're going to be able to go back and put and fill in anything later, forget it. It ain't going to happen. The other thing, that's just from experience, all right? Take it for what it's worth, I guess. The other thing is, I came in kind of late, so I guess I missed a couple of things, but maybe you could just give me some brief responses. The idea of institutions with similar type collections, sharing, cataloging, same type of things, or your comments on sound recording services, cataloging services outside, things like that thing in California.
The problem is that the focus of our session has basically been on the private collector, so rather than the institution. But, you know, I would really encourage private collectors who have similar sorts of collections, if you're working on database programs or computers or whatever, to share your data with another collector who has a similar sort of collection. Why not?
Sure.
You know? If you're not going to share it, maybe you might, I even hate to mention this, but you might like to even sell it. Somebody might be willing to buy it.
Yes. Martin Silver, UC Santa Barbara. I wanted to ask Mr. Canfield about the space requirements for the new program. Have you any idea of how much hard disk space a 10,000 record collection would take on your program?
I can't give you a precise answer to that question. However, I will say we have formulated this program so that space will be used optimally. One of the fields under the miscellaneous task portion of the mission menu is what's it called, Brooks?
Free up memory.
And what this will do is to reduce your field lengths in every given category to the maximum number of characters that you have actually used. Because when you configure the program originally, you set your field lengths to whatever you think you might need in the way of a field length for that given parameter.
Yeah, so I know database programs are very uneconomical.
Right. So you can afford in this program to be generous or a little bit overestimate the size of field that you will actually need because of this other feature, which will allow you to shrink the field to the largest entry that you've actually used. Now, in my business system, which has a completely different program, but there's a similar amount of information being entered. I have an 80 megabyte, two 40 megabyte hard disks in my computer, and I have not yet filled those, and I have more than 80,000 records entered. I would assume that depending on how much information you opt to put in, it would be roughly comparable to that. Maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, for the data storage itself, I'm quite confident that 10,000 records would require well under 20 megabytes of memory. One of the aspects of the program is when you're to the point of printing a report, whatever that might be, in order to have the flexibility to print your report configured in any way that you would like, it will temporarily create another very large database from which it will print that may require an amount of memory comparable to the amount of memory that's used on an ongoing basis.
Wouldn't that be a serious limitation to the use of your program for anybody who has less than 20,000 a 20 meg hard disk?
Yes, if that person had, say, a 10,000 record collection and only 20 megabytes of storage with which to catalog it, it would probably not be feasible for them to catalog those 10,000 records with 20 megabytes.
I see. Thank you.
Uh-huh. They'd have to work. This is solutions to block it.
This is the last question, since we're at the end.
Paul Mahoney from Recordrama again. One thing that I failed to mention, in our new system, we're mentioning scanners here. We have implemented a UPC scanner that we're going to use for entry in and entry out for everything. All the new releases have UPC codes on them, and you can apply them to old recordings. So we're going to be using that starting in July.
Universal price code. That's a standard.
Yeah, that's the product. The universal product code.
Universal product code. Right.
It's the little barcode on the back of your new records. Okay, only new, relatively. Okay, I'd like to thank all of you. I'd like to thank all of you for. Could I finish, please? I'd like to thank all of you for your interesting comments. There were actually more comments than questions, which I thought those were very interesting. I enjoyed them very much. I'd like to thank each of the panelists for their taking their time and for sharing the information they have. I'm sure that they'll all be happy to talk with you about any problems you might have. And thank you very much.
I might mention.